This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C.
A national tragedy for Norway, as at least 91 people are killed in a twin bomb attack and shooting massacre.
When Behring Breivik slaughtered 76 people in Norway last week, the world quite literally watched the heart of a nation break. The mourning continues in Norway, but elsewhere around the globe, political rhetoric quickly took center stage. Perhaps that's a form of collectively dealing with a tragedy of this scale. If we can focus on the bad guys in political terms, we won't have to consider the reality of terrified young people trapped on an idyllic island as one after another is brutally shot to death. But does our rhetoric, even if psychologically justifiable, potentially contribute to something like this happening? This week, we'll look at the massacre in Norway from two perspectives. We'll dig into flaws in our global counterterrorism efforts with Alejandro Butel, government and policy analyst at the Muslim Public Affairs Council. And we'll look at why some consider it appropriate to label Breivik and others as Christian terrorists with Mark Jurgensmeyer, who's written on the topic for Religion Dispatches. But first, this past Thursday, a coalition of progressive organizations, including many faith leaders, gathered at the United States Capitol in Washington, D.C., to send a clear message. Even as the chaos over the U.S. debt limit and federal budget grows ever more intense, it is not acceptable to abandon our collective obligation to the most vulnerable among us. It was billed as the Don't Destroy the American Dream rally. The posturing and politics of the matter are receiving endless media coverage. What I wanted to do was bring you the moral side of the issue. What brought all these people together on a hot Washington day to risk arrest and to say this is not the America we want? I had an opportunity to speak to that crowd, and I can tell you they are full of vigor and conscience, and they want to see this nation do the right thing, and they're fed up with Congress playing with an issue that is deadly serious in the lives of a lot of people. What followed are some excerpts of conversations that I was able to record just before the rally going to the U.S. Capitol and in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol.
We shall overcome someday.
I'm talking with Dr. Paul Sherry.
I am the Washington representative of Interfaith Worker Justice, and I'm the campaign head of a campaign entitled Faith Advocates for Justice.
Have you ever seen a situation in the United States like we're in right now?
No, you know, both you and I, Welton, are getting up there in years, and no, I have not. We've had some very, very difficult days through the years, the Civil Rights Movement, many other movements, but in terms of the mood of this country, And the way we're trying to turn back the years is very, very frightening indeed. It's one thing to disagree. It's another thing to become so entrenched in one's position that one sees it just absolutely impossible to see the other side, and then to begin to vilify your opponent. That has just grown in intensity in recent days, in recent years, and I think unless we do something about it, it's going to get worse and literally begin to destroy this nation and what we're all about.
Sister Simone Campbell, I'm the Executive Director of Network, a National Catholic Social Justice Lobby.
Simone, you've spent a lot of time in Washington. Have you ever seen an atmosphere like we're experiencing right now?
I have, in Weldon. It's so disturbing to me to see the social fabric of our society being very mindfully, consciously eroded and under the guise of a deficit. It is true that we need to get our house in order economically, but the very things that cause this economic crisis are not the issues that are being addressed. It is not about programs for people who are poor. It is not about cutting money to people who are in nursing homes. The problem is not about Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security. The problem is that we have tax cuts for the wealthy that were passed in a time of surplus. That's no longer true. We should reform them. The problem is that we put two wars on a credit card. That's wrong. We should pay for policy that we say we believe in. That is wrong. So I'm just horrified. And quite frankly, after lobbying on Tuesday with all of the leaders of Congress, I was literally in tears at the disaster that we're facing. This is wrong.
This is Wade Henderson, who is a champion of civil rights. We're on our way to the Capitol right now. Wade, have you ever seen the nation like this?
Reverend Gaddy, it's an honor to be with you. And no, not in recent memory have I seen a nation, our nation, so deeply divided and so challenged by circumstances both at home and abroad. If ever there were a time for religious witness or moral witness, it's now.
So I'm Jennifer Butler. I'm a Presbyterian minister, and I run a strategy center for faith leaders that's called Faith in Public Life. And this is my first time ever getting arrested. I've always thought of myself as somebody who would put myself on the line for other people. And yet the opportunity has never presented itself. And I can say I'm nervous and I'm scared to death. Actually, I didn't think I would be because I think of myself as a pretty gutsy person. But I feel like I've been driven to this point because I feel like everything this country stands for, everything my faith calls me to do, is on the line. We are moving toward a society where, our government only supports millionaires and billionaires and calls all the rest of the country to make the sacrifices. We've got to stand together and say this is a country where everybody pitches in and where we don't balance national budgets on the most vulnerable in society. The Bible couldn't be more clear that we're to support the vulnerable and the needy, and that society is judged by that.
I'm standing with Rabbi David Saperstein and Dr. Bob Edgar. We're just inside the Capitol and about to demonstrate our interest in protecting the poor. Have you all ever seen a time when this nation was like it is now, David?
It is hard for me to remember a time. Even in the battles over Vietnam and civil rights, the Congress was able to work together respectfully and find common ground in issues they could work on. And certainly amongst those issues during those years were the increasing government programs aimed at really helping the truly needy in this country. And that's being forgotten today.
Bob, what do you hope to happen today here in the Capitol?
I hope that we start a wave of people across the country who recognize that this whole conversation is not about facts and figures. It's about the impact on children, on the elderly, on the poor, on the working poor. And they've been really left out of this debate. And only the faith community coming together as Christians, Jews, Muslims, and other faith traditions can we stand up and symbolically represent the least of these, our brothers and sisters on planet Earth. After I listened to both Boehner and the president the other night, it was point counterpoint, some good comments, some challenging comments, but I wanted at least to demonstrate to the national public that we are here representing a constituency of folks who have been left out of the conversation and who believe in the next 3 or 4 days that Congress needs to act not just on behalf of the corporations and the wealthy.
For people of faith and goodwill to speak up, and it is time for some politicians in Washington to grow up. We have been told that if there is a fall off in care for the poorest and weakest among us, that the religious community will pick up what the government can't provide.
Oh, yeah, right.
That just shows that you can talk a lot about religion but not know anything about it. We're doing our job. We're doing all we can do to take care of people. We're feeling the pressure already of people needing food and money and housing. It is in the Constitution, as I read it, that the government is to provide for the public welfare. Quit pointing your finger at religion and do what the Constitution demands you to do. I talk a lot about trying to disentangle religion and government. This is a time when religion and government ought to be moving on the same path and acting as best friends. In every tradition that I know, compassion and justice are basic values. Those are also the basic values of democracy. Let us join hands and say to the leaders of our government, from the faith and goodwill community and from the government community, let us provide faith and justice and compassion for people in our country. I want you to know that while you have been here, some of us have been in the Capitol Rotunda.
What?
In the Capitol Rotunda. We are people who think prayer is important, not because it is a public display good for a campaign trail, but because it is a strengthener for people trying to act with compassion. 10 of my colleagues, representing a variety of different religious traditions, bowed in the rotunda of the Capitol. By now, they are probably in paddy wagons being carried to jail. Because we have come to the point of saying, if you won't listen to anyone else, will you please listen to the wisdom of the ages? What happened to all the religion among all the candidates campaigning on it? Where did it go? Religion is not a theory, it's what you do with your life. This nation has a dream in the Constitution, reiterated by the great Dr. Martin Luther King, a dream of which we are stewards, and to fulfill that dream today means to saying to people in power, quit your unpatriotic politics and get on with compassionate acts of goodness and generosity. Thank you for being here.
Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. When lives were violently ended in Norway on July 22nd by Behring Breivik's bloody massacre, that nation fell into mourning. a grief that continues today. Elsewhere, some who were not personally affected by the tragedy immediately began claiming the actions must have been those of a new Muslim terrorist group. Well, that charge only lasted a few hours because Breivik was quickly apprehended. Rhetoric is not going to keep us safe. Effective law enforcement and a functioning society are the only hopes for that. But my next guest contends that we are far from having those resources, and for reasons you might not expect. I'm very pleased to be joined now by Alejandro Butel, who is the government and policy analyst with our friends at the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Mr. Butel is the author of IMPACT's Post-9/11 Terrorism Database. Welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Butel, would you outline briefly what you see as being broken in global anti-terrorism efforts and how that may have been demonstrated in relation to this most recent tragedy in Norway?
Well, that's a very good question. I think what we really need to look at is how the training itself is getting funded. Clearly, since 9/11, everyone is in agreement that we need to make sure that all of our frontline officers, federal, local, and state, are making sure that they get the proper training to recognize the potential signs for any sort of possible dangerous terrorist activity going on. How those funds are being distributed and to whom they're being distributed is what's in question. Mm-hmm. And in particular, there's been a humongous issue of really what ends up being federally funded taxpayer money going to anti-Muslim hate personalities that, unfortunately, when we look at the situation of Norway, had actually been very influential in the case of the actual perpetrator of that particular act.
Can you be more specific about that?
Sure, absolutely. So what MPAC did was we decided to go through the Norway Manifesto, and we found that one out of every 10 citations by internet citations by the shooter, Breivik, included people such as Daniel Pipes, included people such as Robert Spencer, and Waleed Shobat, who has just been exposed on CNN as a fraud and as an anti-Muslim hate personality. Mm. That is extremely problematic. These are the kinds of people that at best provide misleading information to our law enforcement officers and at worst intellectually enable the shooter, people like the shooter in Norway.
I guess as a religious person, I want to try to make a distinction and see if that I'm just doing hopeful thinking. Isn't there a difference in the role religion plays, whether it is real religion that's motivating the person or whether that person is manipulating religion?
Yes, absolutely. And this is the thing about faith in general. And I'm sure, Reverend Gaddy, that as a man of faith, you can understand this in the sense that religion and belief can be used in many different ways. And it can be used to help build societies and to help good. But in this particular case, too, when we're looking at the case of the Norway shooter, it's clear that he was using Christianity, mm-hmm. Not even in a very specific textual sense, but he was using it in some broad sense to justify his own sort of actions, just as unfortunately we've seen how Al-Qaeda has been doing this since 9/11 as well. And so we really need to, when we look and analyze at it, it's clear that when people are using and twisting religion for their own ends, you notice how they take certain quotations of certain religious texts out of context, mm-hmm. or that when they're describing people of another faith, they dehumanize them, whereas the whole purpose of people like Jesus, peace be upon him, and Muhammad, peace be upon him, and Moses, peace be upon him, they're about humanizing people, and they're about trying to uplift the souls of humanity.
Hmm. I'm talking with Alejandro Butel, who is the government and policy analyst at the Muslim Public Affairs Council and a person whose voice and wisdom we need to hear. We've got to take a quick break. We're coming right back. I hope you'll be here. More to come. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. My guest is Alejandro Butel, who is the government and policy analyst at the Muslim Public Affairs Council. We're talking together about the situation in Norway and some of his great insights about what we can learn from it and about international security. Alejandro, we dealt with the question of insanity after the Arizona shootings here in the United States. If the killer is a lone madman, if he is insane, then the search for cause and context can seem futile. In truth, we kind of collectively dismissed Jared Lee Loeffner after some noisy aspersions were cast from various political perspectives. Is there something about the attack in Norway that makes it different? And is it important to look at what may have inspired it?
Well, you know, when it comes to lone wolves, for instance, I think we need to be very clear about something. For every lone wolf, there's a pack mentality, and that a lone wolf still has to operate within a larger political environment. There might be some distinctions, but even Jared Lee Loeffner in some way had a very, very distorted and twisted ideology. And so in the case of Breivik, though, it's quite clear, no matter how you try and skin it, that when this man wrote a 1,500-page political manifesto, this man very clearly had articulated a specific ideology that was meant to justify his attacks. I mean, heck, the guy himself said that the whole point of the killings were in order to be marketing for his manifesto. So I think that pretty much speaks for itself.
Is there anything about Norway that made it more vulnerable to attack?
Only in the sense that I think there was probably a delay in terms of police reaction, and this is me speaking as a counterterrorism analyst, and the fact that the security itself might have been a little bit more lax. But the only other thing that really sort of sticks out to me is the fact that there was such a high increased wave of anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim sentiment that had been going on. And that it created an environment, a special environment of permissiveness, where you had one guy who decided to say, well, you know, all of this is going on. I think logically the government's doing nothing, so it's time that I take action into my own hands.
You know, and I know there have been a lot of concerns that the massacre in Norway might inspire copycat attacks. That's always a concern, I think. If potential terrorists may have learned something from Breivik, have counterterrorism experts like yourself learned anything?
Well, that is difficult to say because I can't read the minds of each and every single counterterrorism analyst. But from what I have seen thus far is that I think it's clear, number one, that people shouldn't be jumping to conclusions. Mm-hmm. Number two is that it's also clear that Islam and Muslims by no means have a monopoly on acts of violent extremism. Mm-hmm. They can come from anywhere, any place, any time, any person, any ideology. Mm-hmm. If we're only looking at one group of people and treating that group of people as a community of suspects rather than partners and as any other community, then it gets to be extremely problematic. And the way that there was a difference in treatment once the perpetrator was known to be an individual who was Caucasian and not Muslim and of a particular ideological bent, then you started to see how people sort of framed and understood and treated the situation differently.
Mr. Boutel, what do you see as needing most urgent improvement in the way we fight terrorism today? And let me just make that a two-parter. And is there a role for religious leaders and for concerned citizens in moving toward that goal?
Training. We need to make sure that the money that's being spent is being spent wisely towards the right people. That means that it should not be going towards federally funded hate mongers, but instead it needs to go towards evidence-based and intelligence-based training. Wherever the threat may actually be, that's what you train for, that's what you look out for. Whether it's Muslim, right-wing, anti-government, anti-abortion, environmentalist, whatever. But as long as you're doing it according to the basis of evidence as opposed to bias. The second thing really is, especially for faith leaders and for average American citizens, is how we talk about the issue. Because when it comes to terrorism, terrorism inherent in the word is terror. And we really need to fight back against terrorism first by fighting back against the fear factor. It's almost like if we look at Al-Qaeda as a bully, bullies themselves become more empowered when they know that they're scaring the heck out of someone. Mm-hmm. And if we refuse to be scared, that I think is number one, a huge step in the right direction that really, really then takes away a lot of power from groups like Al-Qaeda or even people like Breivik as well and other sort of extremist groups across the ideological spectrum.
My guest has been Alejandro Boutel, who's the government and policy analyst at the Muslim Public Affairs Council. I'm serious, Mr. Boutel. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio. You've helped us immensely.
Thank you, sir, and God bless you.
We have to take a quick break, but coming right up, another perspective on the origin and ongoing threat of right-wing terrorism around the world and the effect of the language we use to talk about it. This is State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. You know, there's something perversely comforting about the fact that regardless of how horrible a human tragedy, regardless of the specifics or locations of that tragedy, we're certain to hear the same people saying the same things in the aftermath. The script is well established by now. Something blows up or someone shoots an unthinkable number of innocent people somewhere in the world. Seconds later, voices are raised insisting that Muslim jihadists are to blame. Typically, this is then disproven within hours. Next comes the charge from certain quarters that the tragedy was perpetrated by a Christian terrorist, a phrase that I think is as unhelpful as Muslim terrorist or atheist terrorist when it comes to collectively understanding a horrible event such as this, the actions of an individual that are used to judge an entire ideological or religious group. It reduces us to keeping score. This was one of your guys, so what you people are like, we know, and it's happened again. The initial assumption that the action was somehow inspired by Islam was quickly rebutted, and what followed were logical, if extremely unhelpful, references to the actual faith and convictions of Behring Breivik and noisy charges from conservatives that references to Breivik's self-avowed beliefs demonstrated a hatred for Christians. In looking at this tragedy, its impact on us collectively, and the importance of how we talk about it, I wanted to hear from Mark Juergensmeyer, who wrote insightfully about the subject for Religion Dispatches. Mr. Juergensmeyer is professor of sociology and director of global and international studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His books include Terra in the Mind of God and The New Cold War, Religious Nationalism Confronts the Secular State. Professor Juergensmeyer, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, in addition to your extensive background in this area, you also have done something that I imagine most commentators on the Norway Massacre have not even considered doing. You have actually read the 1,500-page manifesto written by Behring Breivik prior to his bloody rampage. Why did you feel it was important to do that, and what insights did you get from it?
Well, this is an interesting story. I had no choice. About a year ago, I was interviewed by a Norwegian broadcasting company regarding my books on religious terrorism, about the general phenomenon of religious violence, which has not been a feature of Norway, of course, and I've been to Oslo a number of times, and it's it's a very tranquil city, proud of its multiculturalism. But when this incident happened, then the journalist whom I had who had interviewed me in Norway immediately contacted me, and on Saturday, just the day after the event, he sent me this manuscript without any comment and said, "What do you think of this?" And the first thing I noticed was that it had, the author was Andrew Bruick. And I said, that's funny. That simply looks like the anglicized name of Anders Breivik. So I emailed back to him and said, isn't the same guy? And he says, that's what we think. Tell us what you think. So this started a dialogue between me and the journalist. And he was, of course, under a deadline, trying to figure out what was going on in this manuscript and what it meant, beginning with fundamental questions like the date. Mm-hmm. And I think I cracked that. It took a little effort. But the date of it is 2083. And I knew the guy was fascinated with the Crusades. You know, he imagined himself to be part of the Knights Templar. And so I thought, what happened in 1083, 1,000 years ago, which would have been the time of the Crusades? And the only thing I could find was the sacking of Rome by Henry IV. And I knew that was probably not the issue. And then as I read into his own manifesto, looking for clues, because that's what I was trying to do, trying to figure out how this guy thought, what was important, what was his frame of reference, why would he do such a thing, I found the date 1683 very prominently appearing as a critical moment at the Battle of Vienna when the Ottoman Empire's forces were stopped in their tracks. And if the Ottoman Empire had been military had been successful, they would have taken over all of Europe and made it into Muslim territory. And that's what he thought he was doing. He was a part of the Battle of Vienna, the last stand against what he imagined to be the takeover of Europe by the Muslim hordes. So that gives you enormous insight into his mentality, his picture, his frame of reference, that the very title of his manifesto, 2083, was meant to evoke the Battle of Vienna and the, stopping the Muslims in their tracks.
Was that one of those moments when the light came on, or did you feel a chill down your spine?
A chill down my spine. I mean, the tone of his remarks from the very outset was this paranoid fear of Islam and the hatred, not so much against Muslims, interestingly, but against the multiculturalists, the liberal politicians and humanitarian-thinking citizens like me. They held us responsible for the kind of multiculturalism which he thought was simply a Trojan horse. It was the entry into which, Muslim takeover would emerge. That was his kind of ideological paranoia.
Well, writing in Religion Dispatches, you point out the striking similarities between Breivik and our U.S. homegrown Oklahoma City bomber, Timothy McVeigh. And I have to say, you pull no punches. You identify both as Christian terrorists.
Comparison is striking, right down to the, you know, the fuel oil and fertilizer that was used to explode buildings. And both, of course, thought that they would be igniting a great war. They would be the beginning of a cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil. And in both cases, the forces of evil were kind of multiculturalism, liberals who were allowing, you know, people who are non-white, non-Christian, feminists and gays and immigrants whom they regarded as mud people to come into positions of leadership. They were watering down the purity of what they imagined to be European Christendom. So in that sense, they were both cultural militants. They were fighting for what they imagined to be the purity of Christian society. Is that narrowly religious? Well, it depends on what you mean by narrowly religious. I mean, they were not born-again fundamentalist, believe-in-Jesus-Christ kind of Christians. But, you know, you can say the same thing of Osama bin Laden and the and the most of the Muslim militants that we regard as terrorists. They are not pious people. I interviewed some of these people for my book on comparative terrorism. Mahmoud Abu Lima, for example, the chief organizer of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. He was a Muslim militant, and he was out to defeat what he imagined to be the forces of evil and save the Islamic world, but he was not at all pious as a person. He used profanity, he talked about using drugs, you know, he was not, he was not, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the guy that, Zarqawi, that we eventually killed, it was a, you know, a drug dealer and a gangster in Jordan with tattoos. He was not a pious person. The so-called Muslim terrorists that people were quite willing to call Muslim terrorists are exactly the same kind of people.
Yeah.
So if they're Muslim terrorists, Timothy McVeigh and Anders Breivik are certainly Christian terrorists.
I remember having a conversation with a group of imams from Iraq, and that was actually one of their biggest complaints, the way the news media label extremists by Islamic terrorists or Muslim terrorists. There are a lot of people.
Sure, I mean, around the world, the Muslims were aghast at 9/11. They couldn't believe, to this day, the average Muslim couldn't believe that a Muslim would pull off such a horrible act of terror. And as a result, you have all these conspiracy theories about, in the Muslim world, about it must have been, you know, the Israeli Mossad, it must have been the US CIA. It couldn't have been a Muslim group, just as in the United States right now and in Norway, people are saying, no, Breivik couldn't have been a Christian. No Christian would really do this. Well, no person with peace in his heart would do such a thing, but a Christian nationalist sure as hell would.
Well, I know it bothers you, but you're disagreeing with Bill O'Reilly completely, but we'll leave that for another discussion.
Well, he's right in the sense that no, what he means is no true Christian person with peace in his heart would do such a thing, and no true Muslim person with peace in his heart would be involved in the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. They're absolutely right. These are not deeply, spiritually, peacefully religious people. But that doesn't stop us from calling those guys in 9/11 Muslim terrorists. So that's my point. You're going to call them Muslim terrorists, you got to call these people Christian terrorists.
If there may be a danger in labeling extremists, but there is also a danger in not labeling extremists, and we need to treat both the same.
Sure, and there's a danger in blaming religion for all of this.
And
I agree with Bill O'Reilly on that. This is not religion's problem. People are using religion or imagining the world in ways that involve religion in a very demonic way.
Professor Mark Juergensmeyer teaches sociology and is director of global and international studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. You can read his analysis of the Norway terror attacks and the language we use to talk about such tragedies at Religion Dispatches. Professor Juergensmeyer, you have helped us immensely see behind the scenes on the thinking, and I will have to tell you that if a chill ran down your spine when you discovered it, a chill runs down mine listening to it. Thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I think one of the more important shows we've done in our history. Visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, to listen to show archives, sign up for our podcast, and tell us what you think about the program. I'd be interested in whether you think this is one of the more important programs we've done. What do you think we could do better? Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the listener line, 202-238-3291. Please tell a friend about our show. I say that every week, and I really mean it. I hope not just for publicity purposes for State of Belief Radio, but for community purposes. Get a friend together and talk about the issues we've talked about on today's show. I think it'd be good for all of us if you did that. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. You can find out more information on the work of the Alliance, both in Washington and in chapters across the country, at interfaithalliance.org. This work is important, and it deserves your support. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.